This is Radio Skid Row On Demand.
I have with us Mayor of Marrickville, Joe Halen.
Welcome to the program, Mr. Manu Tari. Kia ora, morena Manu.
The CEO, Make-A-Wish, Gerard Menzies.
Radio Skid Row On Demand.
Radio Skid Row, 88.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Jeff Furlow, and you're listening to the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century on Radio Skid Row 88.9 FM. The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is a weekly program for older Australians where we talk about ageing well. And every week, we'll talk about the issues that affect us as we age, right here and right now.
It happens every day.
And later in this final episode of the first series of the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century in Nostalgia Town, we will be talking to Australia's sweetheart, Little Patty, Patricia Amphlett, about her formative cultural experiences growing up in Mascot in Sydney's eastern suburbs. And before the end of the episode, we'll hear some of the highlights of the show over the pilot season. But first things first, today we are going to discuss accommodation and ageing with ageing issues specialist Karen Curtis, and then my two studio guests who will chew the fat with me on the punters panel. And our expert for the day is Karen Curtis. Karen is a writer and a campaigner on ageing issues. She's a founding member of the Agency Project, which is a co-housing project in the Inner West. And she's leading communications and advocacy for Every Age Counts, a campaign that's tackling ageism. Karen, we're here to talk about accommodation as you age. So what are the accommodation issues facing older Australians in the 21st century?
They're myriad and they're variable depending on the person, because some people like to live in certain kinds of accommodation and other people like other forms of accommodation. One of the things that I think people need to remember as they get older is that their needs change. And like your needs change when you're a younger person, so, you know, you live at home with a family in a family home as a child. Generally, you might spend some time in share accommodation as a student. Eventually, you might rent your own place, you might buy a place. You might need a bigger place when you have a family. If you have a number of children, you might need to have a home that has, you know, lots of bedrooms and a big backyard. But then often what happens is that as you get older, you don't necessarily need the same things. And one of the other things that happens or can happen as you get older is that your health profile changes. You might find that your mobility is affected, particularly people who are at risk of some kind of frailty. You know, if you can't walk very far, then if your home that you live in is a long way away from the nearest shop, or it's difficult, it's got lots of stairs or something, and, you know, to get to the car is difficult. If you lose your license, which happens to some people, often thankfully not till quite late in life, but it can happen for different reasons. People lose their license. Sometimes it's sensory impairment, you know, eyesight or changes. Look, there's a myriad of reasons why you might have to think about where you're going to live if you don't want to have to move in your later years.
So what alternatives are there at present to traditional accommodation?
So the obvious thing for most people is that they just stay living where they are, which is fine in many circumstances. If your health is fine, if where you live is not too difficult to manage given your health profile, if it's located close to things that you need to have access to, like shops and other services and medical things, whatever you need in your life. So your home that you've always lived in might be fine, but if it's not, then what are your alternatives? Location is a really important thing for where you live as you get older. It might be lovely when you, a at a different stage in your life, to be a tree changer or a sea changer, and to be somewhere in a community that might be very beautiful but doesn't have access to a lot of services, and it's not very walkable. So if you need to go to the shops, you have to get in your car and drive somewhere. All that's wonderful when all that works. But if you want to kind of future-proof your life and maintain independence as you get older, if you're living somewhere that's a long way away from services, then you're going to rely on other people to help you get to those services if you need them, if something goes wrong. While things are going well for you and you're just having a happy retirement, everything's going well, and you're living in your own home, that's all fine. But if things go wrong, that's when you can really kind of come unstuck. Like if you have an accident, if you have a fall, you end up in hospital, or if you have a stroke, or maybe your partner becomes ill and you need to be close to a hospital or whatever, that's when you really have to start thinking about where you live and the design of the place where you live and how accessible it is, and if you ever need to use a wheelchair or other mobility aid, are you able to get in and out of the doors well? You know, what about your car? There's all these things you need to think about. If you're looking for an environment to live in that tick a lot of those boxes in terms of having access to support, being, you know, part of a community and possibly having some kind of health or aged care services attached, there aren't that many options. There are traditional retirement villages, which I have to emphasise are not aged care facilities. People often mix the two of them, but the traditional retirement village is really just townhouses or perhaps a high-rise. It's a form of accommodation where people have to be over the age of 55. There are a number of different retirement village acts. They're all different in each state, but all of them being for people only over the age of 55. And in practice, the average age of occupants tends to be in their late 70s to mid-80s.
Hi, I'm Susan Ryan, and I was Australia's first Age Discrimination Commissioner. You're listening to The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century. Get connected, stay connected.
We are speaking with Karen Curtis, who is with the Every Age Counts campaign. We are speaking about accommodation and ageing, and about living in retirement villages where occupants can be asked to pay a deferred management fee. I asked Karen to explain what a deferred management fee is, and this is how she answered.
When you move into a retirement village, you pay a certain amount up front, and then you pay fees on top of that to cover things like the maintenance of the garden. And say you pay $300,000 to buy a two-bedroom unit in a retirement village, and then you might pay $12,000 a year or something for various services, depending on what they offer and how much it is and where it is and all that market rate sort of stuff. But then when you go to sell, depending on the contract you have, the contract might say, well, when you sell, we sell it and we insist on renovating it, and that will be at your expense. So it might be that they say, okay, we'll sell it for whatever the price is now. And now that price might have gone down. You might have paid $300, maybe the going rate, because now the retirement village is 10 years older and there's a new one that's been built up the road and there's more competition. So maybe the price of your retirement village unit has gone down. And on top of that, the contract might say that you are responsible for the cost of a new kitchen and bathroom and a refit out, a refurb, before they sell it. And then when they sell it, they might say, well, we 10 or 15% of the cost that comes out of that. So this is why people get really upset, because it's not like buying a normal apartment or a house where you lose your stamp duty, you lose your agent's fee or whatever, but you know that it's all up front. And it is all up front, to be fair, in a retirement village contract, but the problem has been that retirement village contracts have been infamous for being opaque and hugely long and complex, and even lawyers struggle to understand them. And people just sign up because often they're desperate. They need to move out of the house that they're living in, and so people have been caught. So this deferred management fee is that you don't pay it up front, you pay it on exit, and it might be 15%. They say, well, this is the fee that we charge in retrospect for having managed your unit and the service and managed all the finances and everything. And people get very upset about it, and so do their families often.
So what can older Australians do to ensure their accommodation needs are best met?
Well, I think people need to be really practical about their accommodation needs in their older age, in the same way that they are practical about their accommodation needs when they're younger. They often just deny being older. We hate this idea of having different needs just because we get older. You know, we hate acknowledging that we might get sick or something might happen, we might have arthritis. There are all sorts of things that can happen with age. It's not the end of the world, and it's people go on continuing to have an amazing life. But you just have to adjust things. If you don't acknowledge and accept that there might be change and you don't plan for that and make adjustments, if you deny it and you continue to deny it, then that's when things can come unstuck. Because if you've been living in a big, beautiful home, you know, up on the side of a cliff with lovely views and lots of stairs, and it's a long way away from the nearest shop, and you have a stroke or your partner has a stroke or you have some sort of accident and you need to use a wheelchair, well, suddenly your beautiful home becomes a prison. You become completely dependent on other people. Maybe you can't even live there anymore. I mean, this is unfortunately what happens to a lot of people, is that some terrible incident occurs, they're in hospital and the nurses and the doctors say, well, you know, you can't go home, because they send someone home to look at that house and you're not going to be able to go home. They don't have an alternative. They don't have a home that's suitable to go home to. So they start saying things like, well, really, probably you need to start looking at an aged care facility. And then it becomes a real rush. So to get back to your question, Jeff, if you have thought about where you live and the kind of home that you're living in terms of where you live, is it close enough to the services that you need, to shops and the doctor and public transport and things like that? Is it close enough that if you're on your own, you don't have to rely on someone else? Can you get there? Can you walk? Can you walk to a bus stop and get on an accessible bus? Is it located well? And also, what kind of home is it? You know, is it one that has a lot of stairs? If you had a mobility problem, would you be able to get into the house? Would you be able to use your bathroom? Would you be able to get into your bedroom? Or is it up a set of stairs? I mean, where I live in the inner west of Sydney, a lot of people live in terrace houses. Often they've got really narrow, steep staircases. Now, if you have a mobility problem and all the bedrooms are upstairs, well, that's really tough, getting up and downstairs. That's what I would say to people. Try and be practical. No one's saying, oh, you have to go and live in a single-level retirement village unit or something, but they're the kinds of things you have to think about when you're choosing where you're going to live for your later years. That's why apartments are so good, you know, where they've got lifts. So you can kind of come in at street level, you can go up in a lift into an apartment. If it's been sensibly designed and you can look out for universal design principles, are the doorways wide? Can it be adapted so that you could put grab rails in the shower if you needed it? Because if you can't adapt it, you don't have a choice. But if you can adapt your living environment, if your home or your apartment, if it is adaptable, you can keep living there. If it's well located and adaptable, you can keep living there. But if it's not, you might find that you have to move. And moving, you know, in your 80s, when you've hit a crisis point, is no fun. And that's where people feel they really lose that sense of agency and independence, and they often wish they'd done it a long time ago. That's what I'm doing. I'm only 55 this year, but having worked in and around ageing issues for a long time, it became very clear to me a long time ago. I thought, right, I'm not going to end up in this situation where something happens to me and I'm totally reliant on other people because my home is a prison. I want to downsize. I want to live somewhere that is close to everything that is important in my life, close to my friends, close to the things I want to do, close to transport, and accessible. That's why I'm sort of thinking about an apartment. But a house that's well located and accessible is also good. But you can ignore all that advice, and that's fine too. And some great many people, they live in their same house forever and they never need any services at all. You can be lucky. But if you want to future-proof aging and maintain your independence for as long as possible, thinking ahead about the kind of housing you need and where, you know, where it's located is important.
Do you have any messages to listeners of the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st century?
I think we've got to have a very different view about getting older and a different view about older people. This campaign I work on, the Every Age Counts campaign, is all about tackling ageism. And what we're trying to do is change people's attitudes to ageing and older people so that we don't see ageing as a negative thing that we have to deny, that is always associated with poorly in comparison to other ages. You know, getting older has lots of fantastic things associated with it. I don't know if you've heard about the U-curve of happiness, but people are the happiest in their lives at the beginning of life and at the end of life. And the most unhappy period of life is that period sort of from your, you know, your 30s to your 50s, really, where you're usually at the peak of your busy child-rearing and career kind of period. And as you get older, you kind of make peace with so many things in life, and people repeatedly and in all the literature report feeling so much happier as they get older, really, really kind of find peace with themselves. And it's not all bad. I mean, we've got to push back on this. You know, every age has pluses and minuses and pros and cons, and there are lots of cons about being a younger person or a middle-aged person, and there are some cons about being an older person as well. But these things just are so variable, and we've just got to take the good with the bad and keep living. And we have the same rights, we have the same responsibilities from birth to death, and no one can take that away from you. So keep living, just keep participating, keep being part of society, play a part of the community, work as long as you like. And if anyone denies you your human rights in any of these ways, push back. Don't let them do it. Every age counts. We're all entitled to the same rights, same responsibilities from birth to death. And don't let anyone forget that.
Karen Curtis, writer and campaigner on ageing issues and founding member of the Agency Project, thank you very much for joining us today on the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century.
Thank you, Jeff. It was a pleasure.
Radio Skid Row is Marrickville's own community radio station, representing the voices and diversity of our community. Hidden in the back of the Addison Road Community Centre, we work hard to make great radio with limited resources. We need to raise $36,000 to keep our doors open, and we are turning to the community for help. You can support us to stay on air by making a tax-deductible donation. Go to startsomegood.com/Radio Skid Row and keep it locked to 88.9 FM.
And now it's time for the Punters Panel, where we speak with local older people about the issue of the day. And in the studio today, I have Cherie Thompson, who is the founder and chair of the Inner West Women's Shed, and Yumi Lee, who is the manager of the New South Wales Older Women's Network. Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Lovely to have you.
Yes, it's fabulous to be here on your last program of the first series. Really honoured to be part of your last program, Jeff.
My pleasure entirely. We've been talking about accommodation and ageing, and I've got to say that we more or less had a bit of an emphasis on people who are living in the homes that they own as they age, but not every person, not every older person lives in a home they own. What about you, Cherie?
I can't tell you everything, Jeffrey. No, I'm very blessed. I'm one of the fortunate people in the Inner West who is in Department of Housing.
Right. Well, Jeff, I think you've got to look at the stats in Australia. I think you've got to see that there is, at least in the age groups of 25 to 54, I would say about 45% of them are renters. And if you look at the statistics of people who are in long-term rental, it would be at least about 30% of people.
But we're talking about aging, don't you?
Yes, exactly. So don't forget that people who are renting now, who are going to get older, they don't have the money to have their own homes and do what Karen has said earlier on, you know, to custom fit your home and what have you. They will have to find housing. And the rental situation in Australia is such that the focus is on short-term rental. If you look at countries like Germany, well, they've got long-term rental. It's quite normal for people to be renters all their lives. Whereas here in Australia, we are really, you know, we have this dream of home ownership. And that really traps people into huge debt. And it doesn't take long. It's just a little interest rate rise and you get a lot of people on the brink of not having a home.
I disagree. Because I grew up in the era, I'll be 75 this year, and I grew up in the era of my parents rented in Bondi, and then as soon as other siblings came along, they had their name down for the Department of Housing, and we went to a freshly built house out in the inner west, and they were prepared to live there right through the rest of their lives. But it did get bigger, and their health deteriorated. And because Dad had a good job, they then bought a smaller unit close by. But if you go to where they had been given Department of Housing, everyone is still there. Long-term renters did exist. And in my era, in the 50s, everyone rented. It was an Upper North Shore or a Upper Eastern Suburbs sort of thing. It wasn't the Australian dream in that era of to own bricks and mortar. That's just based on my personal experience.
Right.
But the owning bricks and mortar has only come in with the, is it the X generation or who's before the X generation? I don't know.
Oh, well, but we are the baby boomers. Oh, no, sorry.
No, we're after. We're before. Well, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's only come in.
With the baby boomers.
With Home and Away and all those sort of things. No. We're not the baby boomers, are we?
Well, actually,
don't worry, we'll find out next time.
I think you are even beyond baby boomer, but that doesn't matter.
Thanks for the good news.
You're supposed to be from what's called the quiet generation.
Yes. Oh, that's right.
Sorry,
that's
the silent
right.
generation.
Well, that was wrong, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, so it hasn't been the big dream. Because,
for the silent generation, but more for the baby boomers generation.
Yeah.
For sure, yes. Yeah. Owning bricks and mortar, have your quarter-acre block, a place where you can do your barbecue, throw a shrimp on the barbie.
Yeah.
Yes, and that has trapped a lot of people.
And a lot of women
debt.
I know, especially even from the shed, they're now moving because they've worked and they're getting super and, you know, their situation is better. They are now, after all these years, buying a small unit somewhere. They're not looking at Department of Housing and they're not on the verge of homelessness, touch wood, which is what's happening in my opinion. If you can't afford to buy and because rent is so exorbitant, especially in the inner west, the next step is homelessness.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've got members who are homeless.
Yeah.
Who say that, you know, there are no services which are tailored just for older women. They tell me, look, I don't have a mental condition. Mm. I don't have a drug addiction. Mm. I am not, you know, prioritized. And so they get sent to all these temporary accommodation, you know, together with teams who have a lot of problems through no fault of their own. But, you know, our members, they cannot live there because they don't want to be robbed. And so some of them, you know, they say, I'd rather sleep on a garbage bag in Central Station than have to endure living there.
Is it time to think about making more affordable housing available?
Absolutely. Yes. Because I think affordable housing has become big business. When you look at the amount of... I looked up today just online the figures for homelessness New South Wales, I think it is. I could be wrong. Yes, homelessness New South Wales. I think it was last year or 2017. Their revenue from grants was $2 million, and yet the salaries and costs, only one of the expenses, was $724. Now, if there was some, I don't know, government, not a government department, but if they put it out to tender and formed a big company, come on, help me here.
You're on your own, Cherie, because I know Homelessness New South Wales is an advocacy body. They don't quite provide housing.
Yeah, but I'm only using it as an example as to what can be done with all these small time, as this sheet here I have shows, with these all these small time providers who are all putting their hand in the kitty and dipping for grants and for this and for that and for salaries.
Yes.
And all that money could be going into a governing body, which could go to tender or whatever.
Right.
And that could be then distributed, and there's miles of land around the Sydney area, which is, when you look at the new metro train it's in and all that sort of stuff, that could be all a big kitty, and they could be building.
Yeah, but you know, Cherie,
single accommodation or pairs, adult accommodation.
Yeah, but Cherie, I think we need a national housing strategy.
Exactly.
You know, we need the federal government to lead in this area. We need to have we need to have a coordinated approach.
Let's just worry about New South Wales.
Yes,
my darling.
I know.
Smooth talk Albo any day of the week.
But we need to find a way to deal with this problem, and we need to look at the leaders in the world who have done it. Look at Finland.
No time.
I know there is no time. I know we fought about this before, Cherie. I know we have to do it now.
Yep.
But we need to look at the model. Look, you know, if you look at Finland, they have really cut their homelessness rate all the way down, I think, you know, to a minimal number for a country of that size. And simply because the government has taken the lead. They own social
housing.
That'll
never happen here.
I'm an impatient woman and it won't happen here
in the amount of time we had, because look, one of the other figures I found on the 18th of Feb this year, the Inner West Council, they did an audit, I suppose you could call it, and on the count night they found 275 people were staying in 7 local boarding houses. Now, I think it's common knowledge that local boarding houses are not geared for women. Women are unsafe. That's why
right.
women couch surf. That's why
that's
women
right.
are in a desperate situation.
That's right.
And something has to happen now. We don't have time. We don't have time to do these great exposés and spend money and send people over there. Their materials over there are different. Anyway, our maestro here is giving you the wind-up. I shall give you the last say.
Well, Cherie, I think we have to have a national approach. We need to do, I agree, it needs to be done immediately, if not yesterday.
Yep.
And this has to be a priority issue. Housing is
yep.
a national crisis.
Absolutely.
We have over 116,000 people who are homeless in Australia.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Cherie Thompson and Yumi Lee on the Punters panel. Very lively today.
Radio Skid Row is Marrickville's own community radio station, representing the voices and diversity of our community. Hidden in the back of the Addison Road Community Centre, we work hard to make great radio with limited resources. We need to raise $36,000 to keep our doors open, and we are turning to the community for help. You can support us to stay on air by making a tax-deductible donation. Go to startsomegood.com/Radio Skid Row and keep it locked to 88.9 FM.
Thank you.
now for the segment of the show that we call Nostalgia Town, where we talk to well-known older Australians about the musical, the theatrical and the film experiences that helped make them the people they are today.
You must remember this.
Patricia Amphlett, better known to us all as Little Patty, is an Australian singer who performed as a teenager in 1960s surf pop and then in adult contemporary music. Her debut single from November 1963 was He's My Blonde-Headed Stompy Wompy Real Gone Surfer Boy. Patricia appeared regularly on television variety programs including Bandstand and toured supporting Cold Joy and the Joy Boys. Little Patty was entertaining troops during the Vietnam War in Nui Dat in Vietnam as an Australian Forces sweetheart when the nearby Battle of Long Tan began on the 18th of August 1966. In 1994, Little Patty received the Vietnam Logistic and Support Medal in recognition of her services in support of the Australian Armed Forces in operations in Vietnam. How are you today, Patricia?
I'm very well, thank you, Jeff, for a 70-year-old.
It's not possible.
Oh, it is, and do you know, it's pretty good. It's pretty good being 70. I think I'm blessed, though. Most of the time I have good health, so that makes life wonderful.
Yes, indeed. Just because you are ageing doesn't mean that life can't be great.
Oh, no, and the minute you start thinking about that you're ageing, well, why would you do that? Because every day is a new day and you get roll your sleeves up and get on with it.
Absolutely. And getting on with it is what we're going to do. Patricia, this is Nostalgia Town and we speak to well-known older Australians about their formative cultural experiences. Born in 1949, so you remember the 50s. What were the cultural experiences you had growing up?
Although I was born in Paddington at the Royal Women's Hospital, I actually grew up in Mascot and East Lakes, both of which were, and I guess still are, what we would call working class suburbs. Perhaps East Lakes was a little posh, not much, but my memories of growing up in Mascot were fabulous. And I think one of the best memories was that I took it for granted that my neighbours were not just Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-Celtic people. They were Chinese, Yugoslavs, we had Germans, we had Eastern European people and Italians and Greeks. And it seemed to be very multicultural. As I said, I assumed that everyone grew up in an area like that, but of course they didn't. Most of the music I loved was the music played at home by Mum and Dad, who, you know, there wasn't much money around, but they seemed to be able to afford to buy an LP, a vinyl record. I don't know how often, but there always seemed to be new music. And it ranged from jazz. They liked jazz, big bands, people like Rosemary Clooney, Peggy Lee, Doris Day, Frank Sinatra. Oh, gosh, we all loved Frank. So it was a mixture of that kind of music. And when pop music came along, they embraced that too. I was really lucky that Mum and Dad liked that kind of music as well.
And what about on the weekend? Did you go to the Saturday matinee?
Because I was working when I was 14, my social life was not much of it, you know. I think my social life way in my early teens consisted of going to the beach for a few hours with my brother on Saturday and sometimes Sunday, because that's when the stomp dance began and that's when I started working. So it's a bit of an unusual growing up time.
I have to ask you, was there a real blonde-headed, stompy-wompy, real-gone surfer boy in your life?
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. I was too young. Truly, by the time I was 14, in my final year at school, my workload was immense. And any semblance of social life was really with the people with whom I worked. So no blonde-headed, stompy-wompy. And the people I worked with, they were pretty possessive of me and considerably older. I think if any fella was going to try and be serious with me, they were, you know, deterred by the musicians with whom I worked.
So you were being guarded very closely.
I was guarded. Well, I didn't mind, I suppose, but as I got older, I thought, gee, I don't have any social life. Oh, well, it didn't particularly bother me.
So not really the movies, but you did have LPs, and what about the radio? Was that a part of your life?
Ah, the radio was wonderful. You know, I cried when I heard that Gary O'Callaghan had passed away. He was very much a part of our morning, and, you know, mornings are always busy and everyone's house and the radio would be on pretty loudly, and then the bus stop was opposite, and that's how I got to school. And the girl next door was really groovy. She was a year older than me, which, you know, makes it pretty groovy, and she had a transistor radio. So when she was at the bus stop, she used to play the transistor radio. That's Jennifer is her name, lovely, still a friend. So we thought we were pretty hip. I know that we were always at the bus stop in time to hear Sammy Sparrow. If you lived in Sydney, you knew about Sammy Sparrow with Gary O'Callaghan.
And I remember how my older sister had a tranny, not just a transistor, a tranny.
Oh, a tranny, that's right. A tranny, that's what they were called. And they evolved, they became colourful, and, oh, they could have colours for girls. Trannies, boys, trannies. I don't know that I ever had a tranny, but I certainly listened to other people's trannies and loved it.
Now, you did mention jazz, Frank Sinatra, and this was at home, wasn't it? So it was a family thing. This was very
That's
special.
Right. Gene Krupa, Artie Shaw, I'm remembering some of the band leaders' names, and it was kind of big band jazz, I guess that's what you would call it. Yes, it was a family thing. I certainly loved it, and I know my brother did. Perhaps we didn't tell our friends that we liked it, if that makes sense. But I know we both loved our parents' music, and as I said, they ended up loving ours as well. There used to be a theatre in Mascot, an old-fashioned theatre where not only were movies shown, but during the weekends there was live music. And I remember I would have been old enough to have known what feeling embarrassed felt like, but I was a little kid and Mum and Dad would love to go to the night music, and it was a live band, a jazzy type band with crooners. Edwin Duff was one of the crooners. I can't remember who the female singers were, but Mum would walk, you know, a few kilometres, we didn't have a car, with me in the pram. And I remember thinking, oh, how embarrassing. But I guess I would have been perhaps four, and it was a smart thing to do, and you could leave the pram in the aisles. And maybe I got to see half a concert and loved it, and then can't remember getting home because I would have fallen asleep.
Now, you're actually part of the cultural heritage of many of our listeners. I remember listening to you as I was growing up, and I cannot forget that you participated in that At Its Time musical piece that ended up on television in the 1972 election.
Oh, look, it was my parents were Labor people. My dad was around, but my mum had gone. She died quite young. The pride that they would have felt had they known I was part of that commercial, and I felt proud too and still do. And all through my working life, I've still asked to sing that occasionally, not a lot, but at Labor functions, and it still feels good. Those words are wonderful.
They certainly are, but you've got other things to be very proud of. You've made quite a contribution in the Australian Armed Forces. You've went to Vietnam during the war, and you've had an ongoing relationship with the Defence Force. Is that right?
Yeah, I have. Look, I must say that many Australian performers went to Vietnam. I just happened to be the youngest one, and I was 17, and perhaps because I looked a lot younger, that made it just a bit special. And I was there during the Battle of Long Tan and had to be evacuated, which was kind of a big deal. There were years when I was very observant, very inquisitive, and not vulnerable, but impressionable. And I kind of took everything in quite seriously, even though I seemed to be just a quite shy kid. And the fact that these young men, and they were young men, were in a war that I knew that lots of them didn't want to be in that war, and many of them were conscripts. And my brother had, his number hadn't come out of the barrel, so he might have been conscripted. It was pretty close to my heart, all of that stuff. And then when I saw how they came home and were treated not well, and people didn't understand them, because we lost the war, you know. Australia didn't treat them well at all, and in a way that formed my feelings for the rest of my life. Yep, I've got lots of Vietnam veteran friends, their wives, their families, and, yeah, they're my heroes. I think they're the greatest.
Thank you very much for sharing that with us. It was obviously a very, very difficult time for Australia, and it is perhaps a point of shame that we did treat our veterans, our Vietnam vets, so poorly at first.
And it shaped my thinking in other ways. The pride and the feeling I had towards the soldiers went hand in hand with the fact that I became such a pacifist. I marched in the moratorium after I'd been to Vietnam, and sometimes people don't understand that, but I guess in a sentence I could say that one can be a pacifist and hate the idea of war, but at the same time be extremely proud and supportive and respectful of our military forces.
That's marvellous, Patricia. Thank you. Now, Patricia, born in 1949, that means this year you're 70.
I have turned 70.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, Patricia, can ageing be fun? What are the benefits of ageing?
Oh, look, it can. I know it can be fun. And if your friends and your family happen to have perhaps even a wicked sense of humour and a sense of fun and don't turn into old narcs, none of us are that, oh, I think it's a great time of life. It's a wonderful time of life. The fun you have is definitely with your family and friends, and it's what you talk about and what you observe and just great conversations, really. And, you know, all the things that go with that, good meals, good company. My social connections are very important, and my family being part of that, of course. I have many, many acquaintances, but I guess, in all honesty, a handful of people I call very close friends, and I just love them, and likewise for them, and that's just great.
Any final message you want to pass on before I ask you what song to go out on?
Yeah, I don't know about messages, because we all grow old differently. I think if you have good health even up till now, and some of us are luckier than others, so that's such a treat to feel well. My mum and dad always said, don't judge anybody and try and imagine that you're in their shoes, you know. So I've taken that through my life, and that's worked pretty well, actually. So depth of understanding, I hope I can attribute that to my mum and dad.
Patricia Amphlett, every guest on Nostalgia Town gets the opportunity to nominate a song to go out on.
Well, not every day, but lots and lots I think about the Bee Gees. I grew up with them, and we were, particularly the twins, we were exactly the same age, and everyone else seemed so much older, so we were able to be kids for a bit longer, and their music is divine. I love all of their songs, but I particularly like How Deep Is Your Love.
Patricia Amphlett, thank you for joining us on Nostalgia Town today.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you.
Radio Skid Row is Marrickville's own community radio station, representing the voices and diversity of our community. Hidden in the back of the Addison Road Community Centre, we work hard to make great radio with limited resources. We need to raise $36,000 to keep our doors open, and we are turning to the community for help. You can support us to stay on air by making a tax-deductible donation. Go to startsomegood.com/Radio Skid Row and keep it locked to 88.9 FM.
Now, instead of our usual final segment called Out and About, we'd like to play back some of the highlights from previous episodes. Our very first guest was Susan Ryan, who was Australia's first age discrimination commissioner, who told us about attitudes to ageing in Australia.
Well, Australia is very ageist, and what that means is that as people get older, they notice that suddenly, instead of being taken seriously for whatever they are, whatever they've done, whatever they're doing, they're suddenly put in a little stereotype box called an older person. When I was at the Australian Human Rights Commission, I had conducted our first national research project into ageism, and we found that it was very widespread, and it's very damaging to older people to be treated in an ageist way.
Australia's first female member of Federal Parliament, Linda Burney, agrees with Susan Ryan, but told us that things are different in Aboriginal culture.
I think that's very true. I don't think Australia or Australians value older people like they should. I mean, I'm Aboriginal, so within Aboriginal culture, age does bestow on you some very great things like knowledge and maturity and understanding, and you don't become invisible. But I think in the broader community, that's certainly the case.
Just a little less attitude, Boomers. A little less attitude coming from the people who need to be shown five times how to use Apple TV. Okay, is that all right? Yeah, you millennials are idiots. Now, do I press the source button? Is Stan on Netflix, Tom? Is Stan on Netflix? Does the TV need to be on? Of course it does! Come on, mate, you went to uni for free. You figure it out.
Claire Mason from the CSIRO researches the social impact of technology in Australia. This was her message to older Australians coming to terms with the rapid changes in information technology.
I suppose I would just say that the technology doesn't determine our future. It's really up to us as human beings to decide what we're trying to achieve and then how technology can help us with that. I think it's really important that none of us feel passive, like that we are personally going to be disrupted by technology so much as empowered.
We had some wonderful guests, including local boy Graham Auntie Jack Bond, who talked about his childhood right here in Marrickville.
Steel Park was an open garbage tip, and Gary and I used to go down there in the afternoon, and for our pleasures we'd go through the garbage tip and find ourselves a couple of good mattresses, a couple of good old Kapok mattresses, take them down to Undercliff Bridge and sail them along Cook's River until they sank. But the great thing was that we actually didn't know that we couldn't swim.
Australian comedian and author Jean Kitson related her recollections of panel vans and drive-ins.
Going to the drive-in, hiding people under the mattress in the back, always hiding people in your car to get into the drive-in. Backing up to the drive-in screen, opening the back of the panel van, or lying there drinking vodka and ouzo in paper cups, Chico rolls, Tim Tams, chips. That's what we did for fun. There was nothing else to do as teenagers. We just sort of drank and drove.
Local girl and Australian Olympic swimmer Dawn Fraser revealed the secret. She is a lifelong fan of the Phantom.
You know, I sort of love the Phantom. I just love his comic books. For my birthday presents, my daughter used to give me comic books, and they were always the Phantom. And now my grandson, Jackson, every time I have a birthday, I don't have a birthday, I have a birthday party every 10 years. I don't have a birthday party every year. They usually go and find some Phantom comic books I haven't got, and that's what I get for my birthday presents.
We also spoke about ageing, retirement and keeping active. Inner West Council's Joint Senior Citizen of the Year, Jude Stoddart, summed it up well.
One of the things I found about retiring, and you were talking about loneliness, is that you suddenly find yourself at home. And I think, well, you know, I used to be out 12 hours a day working, you know, what do I do? And it took me some time to work out a bit of a structure in my life so that I could actually keep going and keep things. And I found it was as important. I had to be slightly encouraged into physical exercise. It was not one of my great things I've done all my life. You know, I spent too long in the office. And so I've taken up sports, and I go twice a week to a great seniors fitness group. and it's an hour and a half of fitness twice a week, and it's such a great group of people. It's good humoured. You know, we joke that we've only got one good body between us all, but actually it doesn't stop us doing a lot of things, and I feel a million times better for it.
Rampaging Roy Slaven himself, John Doyle, made his exercise preferences very clear. You don't slip on the Lycra and get on the bicycle?
No. No, walking and tennis, Jeff. Yeah. That's the answer.
My parents told me they want to buy a caravan recently. Oh, you love a caravan, don't you, Boomers? Boomers look at all the houses there and they go, gosh, just not enough houses here. Is there a way my car could be a house? Just driving around. Hey, millennials, check it out. Beep, beep, pretty cool. I'm living in my car like you, but different.
And I may have managed to antagonise one of our former High Court judges by bringing up his age. Michael Kirby, you're 80 now, and...
Did you have to mention that on a public audience? Oh. I'd like people to think I may be about 60.
Perhaps our most popular and joyful episode was Sex and Relationships as We Age. And when I asked our expert guest, Bettina Arndt, whether sex doesn't just stop when you get older, this is what she had to say.
No, of course not. There was a famous author called Alex Comfort, back in the 1960s, I think it was, wrote a book called The Joy of Sex. And he said, the things that stop you from enjoying sex in old age are the same things that stop you from riding a bicycle. Bad health, thinking it's silly, and no bicycle. And I think that sort of sums it up.
And our studio guests, local older people Beverly Baker and Lorne Hyde, just reaffirmed Bettina's point.
No. Who would want it to anyway? It changes, certainly changes. I remember of a very old joke, what are the three stages of sex? Is tri-weekly, spelt tri with an I, tri-weekly, which is tri-weekly, yep. And the other is tri-weekly, which is weekly with a double E, with an A. So it's tri-weekly. Yes, and right. I think that's probably true. As you age, things don't necessarily work as well, but your emotions, your feelings, those things remain intact.
And you still have desire?
Absolutely.
Absolutely gets better as you get older. I don't know, you've ever heard the saying, older the violin, sweeter the music, or older the buck, stiffer the horn. You know, it's got to be fun. It's not quick. It's not, let's get it over with. It's not that sudden release because I got to have it. It's this wonderful relationship. It's this wonderful sense of togetherness. It's this, it's not rushed.
Bettina made her own very frank and amusing admission when sex in relationships much later in her life came up.
I mean, I remember in my own case, when my first relationship after a long marriage, my first relationship when I was single, and I was very nervous about that and so on, and this lovely man was just being very careful and comfortable with me, and eventually we were on a long walk and I joked to him and said, I'm going to need the WD-40, it's so long since I've had sex. And he said, never, don't worry, I'm a very patient man. And it was such a good answer.
We also spoke about Australia's cultural landscapes with well-known older Australians. John Bell had this to say when we spoke about the time when Australia's iconic play Summer of the 17th Doll was made into a film in 1959, and all four leads were played by Americans.
That was a dreadful thing. Probably, I would say, the greatest Australian play. It's a timeless piece, and it's a wonderful play. It still resonates. And to see it turn into a movie with all American or English actors putting on fake Australian accents was insufferable. Of course, that could never happen now. We have our own film industry, and there's no way you'd get a Hollywood or English actor to play those great Australian roles. So we have come of age.
On a happier note, Susan Ryan spoke about her joy listening to Australian pop music while still a schoolgirl.
Oh, well, I was a beach girl
And I can remember being down on Maroubra Beach when I was about 15, and Johnny O'Keefe turned up. Rock and roll was very new to us then. It was something we saw on television from America, which was also a rare experience. And Johnny O'Keefe turned up in a gold lamé suit and sang this song, Shout. And it really was. The whole beach just gravitated around him, and we were all jumping up and down and shouting. I'd never done anything as a good, you know, convent girl. I'd never gone on like that in my life. But it was fantastic. And that sort of exciting music was great. And it was there on our own beach. We didn't have to go to America. I mean, it was there. And again, with little Patty, when she came along with Stomping at Maroubra and so on, she was a local girl. And imagine hearing a rock song with your own suburb's name in it. Like, that was hugely exciting, and we just loved it.
And this is what former West Australian Premier Jeff Gallop had to say is his favourite Australian pop song of all time.
Well, it has to be Easy Beats, Friday on My Mind. And it's not that I was waiting for Friday, although I was, because I love the weekend sport, but I love school as well. It's just that it was such an important song in the 60s. And the band, of course, too, became legendary all through Europe. They were young migrants. They came to Australia. There was the Dutch contingent, the Scottish contingent. It really reminds me of the 60s. And whenever I hear it, I think of my day in Geraldton. It brings it all back.
This has been the final episode of this series of The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century. You can listen to episodes again by going to radioskidrow.org and searching the SoundCloud box to the right. You can also go to babyboomersguide.com.au for complete episodes, individual segments, and additional material and links. This production was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. This program was produced with assistance from Lex Marinos and Raul Hernandez in the studios of Radio Skid Row. I'm your host, Jeff Worlow. Thank you for listening to The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century.